Sacha Baron Cohen's highly anticipated and controversial new film, Bruno, has finally arrived in theaters. Bruno is the fake documentary saga of an outrageously flamboyant Austrian fashion model who travels to the U.S. to become a movie star. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
To say that Sacha Baron Cohen's Bruno is a Queenie stereotype is like saying water is wet. He's a geyser of swishiness. And Baron Cohen is a big guy, with long arms and legs and a wiggly little butt. And when he sashays forth in a pink jumpsuit or short shorts, he's an amazing spectacle. Bruno is childishly oblivious, a boob, and he parades himself in front of people who are not accustomed to someone so out there, which is to say, most people. For Baron Cohen, the whole world is stooges. Only his audience is in on the joke. We laugh at his marks, never with them. At his best, Baron Cohen is a comic gorilla in the front lines of the war against prejudice and sanctimony. What's open to debate is whether he's also a comic gorilla, a King Kong mauler of innocent bystanders, a cheap shot artist. Well, he's both, which is why I hated Borat, and why I'm surprised to say how much I laughed at Bruno. If Baron Cohen and director Larry Charles's latest provocation seems less sadistic than Borat, maybe it's because flaunting one's gayness in the face of potentially violent homophobes is not just aggressive, it's borderline suicidal. I mean, Bruno puts moves on hunters with guns. The film centers on a doomed quest. After being schwarzlisted in the fashion industry, the Austrian model and exhibitionist flies to Hollywood, determined to become a celebrity. He auditions for appalled directors, draws egregious attention to himself as an extra, and shoots a pilot for a talk show interspersed with semi-pornographic bumping. The camera rests on the faces of the men and women in the focus group as they struggle to keep their revulsion in check. To get the most out of Bruno, you have to suspend disbelief and regard the movie as a hard R-rated candid camera, to accept that, unlike Eminem, who was in on the setup at the recent MTV Awards, celebrities and ordinary people whom Baron Cohen punks are driven to actual sputtering rages. Take the largely African-American audience of the Richard Bey show, when guest Bruno trots out his adopted African baby.
How did you find your son?
I swapped him.
You swapped him? Swapped
the baby for what?
For an iPod.
What?
Not just any iPod, once that was like limited edition, red. A U2 iPod, heard of it?
All right, but wait a second. You are the baby's father now, and you chose to dress that baby up in a T-shirt that says what?
Gaby.
That's not the baby's name, is it?
No, I gave him like a traditional African name.
So what's the baby's name?
OJ.
Here's the question. Is there a larger satirical point, or is Bruno only about pushing buttons? Consider the thrust of that talk show scene. Through ludicrous exaggeration, Baron Cohen is implicitly making fun of hate speech about gay adoption, that children will be ushered into lives of debauchery by perverts promoting an alternate lifestyle. I think that's worthy of ridicule, and the scene is a hoot. But the OJ line suggests he can't resist the odd gratuitous flourish, which is also a hoot, but yes, only button pushing. I watched much of Bruno through my fingers, squirming, especially when Bruno tries to manipulate former Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul into making a sex tape. Nearly as excruciating are his earnest queries to a former homosexual who now works for a church that aims to deprogram gays. See Bruno ingenuously inquire how not to be disgusted touching female bodies, and see the deprogrammer patiently say words to the effect that you just have to take one for God's team. A detour to the Middle East is off topic, but what daredevil from MTV's Jackass ever had the chutzpah to stride through an Israeli Orthodox neighborhood in a black hat, payas, and short shorts? Underlying all these gags, profound and cheap, is a hard truth. Many heteros are still uncomfortable with flamboyant gay behavior. When the arty, painfully discreet Brokeback Mountain came out, some conservative commentators announced they couldn't bear to watch such ickiness on screen. To them, and to everyone who'll see Bruno because it's the new gross-out sensation, Sacha Baron Cohen is mischievously moving the boundary posts, proclaiming, "In your face."
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
Legislation to slow climate change rolled into the Senate this week and ground to a halt. After 2 days of hearings, Democratic leaders agreed to mothball the measure until September. They blamed a busy schedule of other priorities for the delay. But in its brief moment in the spotlight, the climate change bill encountered opposition from Republicans and Democrats. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on what it will take to get that measure approved.
The energy and climate bill started out hefty, a 650-odd page prescription for a new energy economy. When it passed the House of Representatives, it had ballooned to a 1,400-page giant. That's what it seems to take to design a cap-and-trade system. It puts a cap on emissions of greenhouse gases that warm the planet and allows companies the chance to trade permits to emit those gases. In the first day of hearings before the Senate Energy Committee, Republican Kit Bond took the first of many swings at this whole notion.
And I think the American people, and certainly my Missouri constituents, deserve to know how the legislation we consider will impose new energy taxes on them, kill their jobs, punish the Midwest and South, help China and India, and construct a new bureaucratic nightmare to implement a carbon cap and trade program.
The White House had sent senior officials to the committee hearing to explain how this would work, but Republican Jim Bunning of Kentucky told them it was a waste of time.
I have more than once pointed out that any action to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions will be pointless if there aren't similar limits on emissions in China, India, Russia, and other countries.
China is the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, and India isn't far behind. Bunning says if the U.S. limits emissions by itself, prices will rise here but not abroad, and that will hurt consumers and undercut American business. When the bill encountered these arguments in the House, supporters simply loaded it up with concessions to win over wavering representatives, provisions to help industry make more ethanol fuel from corn, for example. That kind of deal-making has already begun in the Senate. At this week's hearing, GOP Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee made it clear what he wanted to see in the bill in his questions to President Obama's Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu.
Why don't we have the same level of enthusiasm for nuclear power that we do for wind turbines? What's the reluctance here?
Well, actually, for me, you're not going to get any reluctance. I as you may know, I think the nuclear power is going to be a very important factor in getting us to a low-carbon future.
For Alexander, it's nuclear power, but every state and its senators has its own energy wish list. There's a legion of lobbyists and advocacy groups keeping track of these lists. Lisa Jacobson is one of them. She's with the Business Council for Sustainable Energy, which represents green companies and favors the bill.
You know, some states are more resource-rich in coal. Others are the Saudi Arabia of wind energy, or they have strong solar resources.
Jacobson adds that the hobbled economy is also shaping the demand senators are making.
Midwestern senators in particular are very concerned. You know, they're hemorrhaging jobs.
So California Senator Barbara Boxer, the Democrat who's shepherding the bill through the Senate, is promising that it will subsidize green energy technologies and thereby create new jobs. Lobbyists and energy analysts calculate that about 24 senators are on the fence right now. Bill supporters say they'll need to capture over half of them to get the votes to pass the bill. With the postponement, they'll have the rest of the summer to try. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
The recession has been good for one business, community colleges, which are cheaper than four-year schools. So enrollments are soaring, but their funding is not. NPR's Greg Allen reports that may lead to a lot of disappointed students this fall.
The fall session is still weeks away, but you wouldn't know it from the activity at the registration and admissions office on the campus at Miami-Dade College. At 7 a.m., an hour before opening, students are lined up waiting to enroll and sign up for classes. Administrators say there are more students looking to attend this fall than they've ever seen before. In large part, it's because of the economy. many who are out of work are seeking to improve their education so they can get better jobs. There are also students who in better times may have gone to college at higher-priced institutions. Julio Tortone is an incoming freshman who was accepted at the University of Miami, where tuition and fees are over $42,000 a year.
The reason I'm registering here is because there's no money, you know? I just registered right now. Hopefully, you know, I'll get the classes I want. I registered for the fall term, so we'll see how it goes. But I've noticed that the line is getting bigger and bigger every day, seriously.
The bottom line, tuition and fees here at Miami-Dade College total just over $1,000 per term for Florida residents. Across the country, educators at community colleges say they've often seen enrollment surge in times of economic slowdown. The size of this spike, however, is unprecedented, and it comes at a time when budgets are severely limited. Dulce Beltran is the registrar at Miami-Dade College.
As it stands right now, we have almost 39,000 students registered for the fall term, and we began fall registration only 2 weeks ago. And a quarter of the courses are already closed, with almost 2 months to go before fall term begins.
Enrollment is running nearly 60% ahead of last year's pace. Miami-Dade College has scrambled to hire instructors and add courses. At the same time, administrators have cut costs elsewhere and increased class sizes. Even so, Beltran estimates that 20,000 or 30,000 students won't get all the classes they need. 5,000 may not be able to sign up for any classes in the fall. With 80,000 students receiving college credit, Miami-Dade is the nation's largest community college, so the numbers here are extreme. But across the country, it's a rare institution that's not in a similar situation. At Broward College near Fort Lauderdale, administrators say they can't add enough freshman introductory courses to meet demand. Second-year student Wally Honorit says it's also hard to get a place in lab courses, such as the anatomy class he's taking for his physical therapy degree.
The first day I came in there, I think I was maybe 10 minutes early. I walked in the class was full. I'm the last person in the back right next to the door in the trash can. So it was like, man, you know, that was what's going on. You know, it's real competitive to even get a seat now.
At another time, surging enrollment might be seen as a boon. This spike, however, comes as state and local governments are steadily cutting their financial support for community colleges. A decade ago in Florida, the state legislature provided more than three-quarters of the operating budgets at community colleges. It's now dropped to about 50%, and Broward College President David Armstrong says even that support is shaky.
In the last 3 years, our state support has declined 22%, about $18 million.
To help make up that gap, Broward College raised tuition this year by 8%. Armstrong says he's hopeful that as the economy improves, Florida will restore the funding it's cut.
We'll have years to climb back out of this hole that has been dug in the budget, though, and the state is facing many other issues that compete with our needs in community colleges, universities, and K-12. There's health issues and all the prisons and all the other things that the state has to budget.
It's a similar story in California, Arizona, and according to Norma Kent of the American Association of Community Colleges, at almost every one of the group's 1,200 member schools.
The state of Washington, for example, has experienced the highest budget cut for the community colleges that they've ever had. The state of California is in a very dire straits that you hear about every day, and they've projected they may turn away as many as 200,000 students this year.
Making matters worse here in Florida is that because of budget cuts, the state's 11 public universities have imposed caps on freshman enrollment. That's not possible at community colleges, where an open-door policy allows admission of anyone with a high school diploma or a GED. In Florida, California, and many other states, that open-door policy is now taking a beating, as thousands of students are being shut out of classes and potentially careers. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Up next, Flora's here. Hi, Flora. Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week. What have we got this week?
Hi, Ira. This week we have I think it's sort of seasonally appropriate. People are spending a lot of time right now mowing their lawns. And our senior producer, Annette Heist, is no exception. And so we started looking into to grass alternatives.
Alternatives to growing that, because you have to mow it every week.
You have to mow
people
it,
put all kinds of stuff
fertilize
on
it.
Weedicide, insecticide, all that stuff.
So is there a better way is the question. And we went on a little field trip to meet David Benner, the moss guru.
The Moss, the Moss Guru?
Yes, that's right.
M-O-S-S?
Yes, no Moss. I mean, yes, Moss.
And where was he?
He's in Pennsylvania outside of New Hope near the Delaware River. And he got rid of his grass 40 years ago.
Wow.
In lieu of moss. So he explains this history of how he killed his grass, which basically he made the soil very acidic using ammonium sulfate and sulfur powder.
Wow, killed the grass.
Killed the grass, and a year later he had moss lawns everywhere.
Wow.
Now, not everyone can do this. You need shade.
Right. But you went out to him, visited him, and if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, there's the video you made with Annette exploring.
That's right. I mean, it's a spectacular garden.
Yeah.
Really is amazing.
Does it look like grass or look like little mounds of moss, you know, that you see growing?
It's very green. I mean, you know, it doesn't look like grass because it's much shorter.
Right.
It's sort of like a carpet.
And you don't have to mow it ever.
You don't have to mow it. He says you don't even have to water it. This was sort of a surprise.
Yeah, I thought you need a lot of water for a moss.
Apparently moss is really resilient. So even if it goes weeks without water, it'll kind of dry up. But then he says anyway that an hour after a rainstorm, it springs back to life.
I have tried to get moss off my shingles on the roof, and it knows how to come back. I've been up there with everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think acidic soil, he says, it'll sort of take off. And one thing that I thought was really interesting, this was kind of like a mystery solved moment for me, was how moss grows on rocks and tree bark. And the answer is that moss doesn't have roots. So really any flat surface it can grow on, and it takes in its nutrients through the air and from rainwater through its leaves or
right.
its moss body.
It's moss body. So you don't have to – that's why it doesn't need to be fed and worried about and taken care of it.
Right, and why it can grow kind of almost anywhere.
Especially here in the East, we have all this acid rain, right? It likes that acid soil.
Yes, exactly.
So but you can't have sun.
No, you can't have sun. It's really for people who have a shady yard and
northern exposure, so to speak, because that's where it grows. And you have the video up on the website. If you want to do this yourself, can you like put plugs of moss that it'll spread on its own?
Yeah. So his son actually has a business, Moss Acres, that sells moss. But he said that you can also kind of transplant it just in little pieces to places in your lawn, and it'll fill in. Now it takes kind of a while.
Yeah.
But
it's a long-term project.
It's a long-term project, but it sounds like it might be worth it.
I mean,
no mowing.
No mowing. Well, there you go. Flora has got our video pick of the week out there in Pennsylvania, a tour of the guy's moss farm, I guess.
His moss garden and Annette's house.
And Annette's house. So you can see both on our pick of the week on sciencefriday.com's website. Thank you, Flora. That's about all the time we have today. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Ned Heist. Charles Berkowitz is our director, and Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher, our site arts producer. Our intern is Eric Ortlip. Neil Rausch, our technical director, right there at the controls here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, University of Denver. And please take a few minutes out while you're looking at the video of the moss on our website at sciencefriday.com. Click on the right side there where we have a little survey. Just take a couple of minutes and fill out the survey. It'll help us know who you are and give us a little more information about you. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. The White House has spent part of this week dealing with economic anxiety. Rising unemployment numbers, 9.5% now, may be connected to some slipping poll numbers. Yesterday, Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown told us that people are frustrated. They expected a big economic stimulus plan to show more results sooner. One big question is how much longer the White House can blame the economy on the last president. We dropped by the office of a leading House Republican, Eric Cantor of Virginia. He's already argued that the stimulus failed.
Here's something I'd like to know. In your mind, what is a reasonable amount of time to give this administration to do whatever it can to turn the economy around that it says it inherited?
Steve, I don't necessarily think that's the right way to approach this question. When we considered the first stimulus bill in January, representations were made, promises were made by President Obama that if we acted quickly and passed the bill, we'd be able to stave off job loss and stop the unemployment rate from exceeding 8.5%. So I think that the proper test is the representations and promises that were made did not come to fruition.
But the reason I ask that is because, as you know, the administration has said, wait a minute, we never said it would work in the first few months. We have not even gotten around to spending all the money yet. Give us a little bit of time. What is a reasonable amount of time to give them?
Well, again, this is not what the administration said. The administration said that we needed to act with a sense of urgency. That is how we were going to be able to save jobs and avoid folks from having to go in the unemployment lines. That should still be our goal. We shouldn't have been expediting the review of an 1,100-page bill without anyone in the House reading it if the course that we expected was going to be a 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 year period in which to see the money go out. That's where we get into the situation where you waste taxpayer dollars.
Although the administration is saying now, it took years to get into this mess, it'll take time to get out. What's a reasonable amount of time? What's the time on the clock for him as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, Steve, there's not a question, and we shouldn't be arguing about how we got here because that's pointing blame. I think the American people are tired of that. They want to know how we're getting out of this situation. Republicans had a plan. I went and personally gave him our stimulus plan back in January. We still want to work with this president. The way we see an economic recovery coming about is through investment. We've got to get small businesses back into the business of putting their money to work, taking risks so that jobs can be created.
Do you think that the economy will be the heart of next year's congressional elections?
Well, listen, no one has a perfect crystal ball, but clearly I think that the economic situation before us needs to be satisfied in order for the electorate to begin to have some confidence in their leadership. I think what you're seeing in polling right now is a reflection of the fact that this president and this Congress own this economy.
How many Democrats do you think are vulnerable?
Well, Steve, again, you look at the numbers out of last election. There are 49 Democrats sitting in seats that John McCain won. Obviously, not all of those are vulnerable, but I do think you start there. And then you also begin to look at the seats that have, you know, individuals who are new to Congress that perhaps were in seats that were held by, you know, the Republican candidate prior. So I do think that there are a sufficient number of vulnerable Democrats that will allow Republicans to make significant gains if not take over this Congress and the U.S. House in 2010.
Congressman, thanks very much.
Steve, thank you.
Congressman Eric Cantor, Republican whip from Virginia.
And on to some other big political questions. Do we need a recovery from the recovery? Are the Democrats on track to overhaul health care? And what about the president's week of summitry? Well, joining us, as usual, are columnists E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back.
Thank you. Here.
But let's start with the recession and the recovery. E.J. first. There's a lot of talk about the need for another economic stimulus and whether there's the political will in Washington to pass one. What do you make of it?
I think the short answer is right now there isn't the political will. I think the president probably wishes that the first stimulus had been a little less bipartisan and a little bit bigger. There's a case to be made for doing more, particularly for all these state governments that are having to cut programs and raise taxes at the same time, which is about as anti-stimulative as you can imagine. If we ever get a second stimulus, that's where it's going to come from. But I think the administration's view is this isn't played out yet. There's still a lot of money to be spent. And I think when President Obama went to Rome today, he was probably praying that something happened to pick up this recovery a little bit.
David Brooks?
EJ wants it partisan and profligate. I guess I don't. I wish it had been timely, temporary, and targeted, to keep with the alliterative theme. The problem with the stimulus is it wasn't designed to happen in 2009. Most of the spending is happening in 2010. And so it wasn't really designed to be stimulative because they thought the economy would be growing along nicely by 2010. The problem now is even if you did pump money into people's pockets, people are so scared they're just not spending it. So it's not clear we can stimulate in the short term anyway.
People might pay off their credit card debts, sure.
Or just
save it. The savings rate is way up.
An odd thing that would be. Let's talk about health care reform for a second. David, do you hear in the announcements of cost-cutting commitments and arguments over a public insurance fund, do you actually hear the makings of a potential sweeping, effective bill on health care reform this year?
Not effective, and maybe not sweeping. This has certainly been the worst week they've had for passing any kind of health care bill because Democrats basically can't decide how to pay for it. A lot of us are more concerned about the second issue, which is lowering health care costs. The growth of health care inflation, to me and I think to a lot of people, is the core issue about without which we cannot have reform. It's squeezing the middle class, it's destroying jobs, it's bankrupting the country. And there has been a bipartisan consensus not to seriously tackle that issue, not to control what's being spent, and not to control the treatments that are offered by people. And both Republicans and Democrats are completely in agreement on this, and as a result, we'll probably get nothing that controls costs.
Controlling costs, EJ, means telling patients you may have to pay more for insurance, doctors you may have to make less, hospitals you may have to do less, insurance companies you'll have to profit less.
Well, I think we don't have to drown in David's sea of pessimism there. I think that what you've got are a lot of ideas floating around that are still very much alive about paying doctors in a different way that create incentives for savings, using research better to know what works and what doesn't. So I don't think we are at anywhere near the dire point that David suggests. What you've got now is a House bill and one of the Senate bills that's reasonably close to what President Obama wants. And then you've got Max Baucus on an endless negotiating
session.
He's
the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee.
Right, correct. Thank you. On an endless negotiation with Senator Grassley, he wants this bipartisan bill. The Democrats are trying to speed up Baucus so they can start putting something together. But where I agree with David is I think the schedule has slipped from where Democrats and the White House wanted it to be, and they're getting a little bit worried.
Would you agree that when a party has the White House, the House, and 60 votes in the Senate, that they ought to be able to pass a major piece of legislation?
Yes, and I think that gives them some leverage over Democrats who might be reluctant to vote for this, that they can say, look, we have all the power now, at least in the eyes of the public, and if we don't deliver on this, we're going to get punished in the next election, which is coming up very soon next year.
I think they'll pass something. I'm not sure it'll be that big or that universal, simply because a lot of people in the Senate want to tax employee health benefits. A lot of people in the House just want to tax the rich. Those are two very different approaches. But just finally on this comparative effectiveness, on the idea that we should measure what works, all the bills have that. All the bills do not force people to actually follow the results of that, and that's where the costs are going to rise.
Okay, last item. EJ, you wrote a column this week about President Obama's meeting with Pope Benedict XVI, in which you said that the Democrats of Barack Obama stand to the right of the Pope on economics.
Right. I mean, the Pope issued a very powerful letter on social justice and the economy, in which he said things that Democrats would never dare say. He talked about redistribution of wealth. He said we needed a world political authority, those are his words, to oversee the global economy in the name of the common good and solidarity and subsidiarity. And he sounded a bit like Bernie Sanders, if I can say it that way, when he condemned corruption and illegality in the conduct of the economic and political class in rich countries. Now, clearly, the Pope isn't to the left of Barack Obama on everything. And when he met with him today, the president met with the Pope, I thought it was very significant. The Pope gave him a document on the life issues and a document on his document on the economy. Critical. It was sort of the yin and the yang of Catholic teaching, to the right of our consensus, if you will, on the life issues, and to the left on economics.
He was offering him cafeteria Catholicism.
No, he was offering him the full deal.
I see. David, I'll leave you a time for one theological note.
Well, my theological note is going to go a little Protestant. It's the 500th birthday of John Calvin, a central figure in American life. He created representative government by disbelieving in unified power. He created capitalism by inculcating self-discipline. He created American exceptionalism by giving us the sense we were following God's will, a major figure who should not be ignored on his 500th birthday.
Happy 500th to John Calvin. David Brooks and E.J. Dionne, thanks very much.
Thank you.